Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Yes. Yes, it's Sunday afternoon. That means we must be burning down the house on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. Today I want to speak with an actor. Do you prefer actress?
Either is fine.
Because acts of architecture have been in my mind recently. And the power of the narrative at its highest level, architecture, should is always a very dangerous word. To my mind, architecture should tell a story about its creation. And the more that I thought about storytelling and narrative, and the narrative that is inherent in the built environment in individual buildings, the more I thought about how do we tell our stories? How is the narrative of a building different or similar to developing a narrative in a work of stagecraft? And then I kept looking around and I found a few other interesting clues that are out in the universe about what is architecture and is it all that different being an actor in the world of creating the built environment from being an actor telling a narrative in the ephemera of stagecraft. My guest today is Jen Tulloch, a native of Louisville.
That's right.
How you all doing?
Yeah. We're doing fine.
That's great. But you don't talk that way most of the time, Jen.
I don't. I'm from a family that did quite a bit of traveling, and we ended up moving abroad when I was a teenager. I was also enamored with and working in the theater from a young age, and had, if about nothing else, I had the presence of mind enough to know that I could not speak the way that my
your homies did.
My homies spoke. And there's nothing wrong with it. Believe you me, when I go home, I certainly go back into the home twang, which I love. But as far as the line of work I was trying to go into, and it just wasn't conducive. But
well, there's a real bias in the Northeast amongst some people, including, for example, our host Katie Kiefer's got a huge Jones on for anybody with any sort of Southern accent. She thinks that they're immediately idiots if they speak that way, which I think is really unfortunate.
It is unfortunate. It's unfortunate considering the actual etymological root of those dialects come from the English.
Yes, the old English, yes.
I mean, if you look at the Deep South, you look at places like Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, where people literally drop their R's and say drawers.
Mm-hmm.
That's directly a derivative from Cockney.
Oh, sure.
You look at the way we elongate our vowels in the South when I go like that and I'm saying, you know, I make everything that might be a short vowel, a longer vowel. That's directly, those diphthongs and vowels are elongated from various English sub-dialects.
Which
as well.
Is why it's always so entertaining when you hear Mick Jagger doing something in a Southern accent. He just has to shift his intonation ever so slightly, and he's right there.
It's very close.
And similarly, when I was in architecture school, our dean was from the Bronx.
Uh-huh.
And he would use his Bronx accent for great effect, because there are a lot of people in educated circles who similarly regard a Bronx accent as being something just one step up from being a knuckle-dragging caveman.
Well, sure. This is because you're talking about mass thinking that you must snap yourself to the status quo and you must sound alike in order to be part of the educated mass.
Well,
right?
That's right.
So anything that is a variation on that agreed upon streamline.
Yeah.
It must be less educated.
And then at the other end of the scale, people with a British accent, especially a London British accent, are immediately supposed by a lot of Americans to be incredibly brainy.
I lived in London for a while, and let me tell you, I ran into many well-spoken, very stupid people. So there are intelligent, incredibly stupid people everywhere with various types of voices.
Well, so in the second half, we might have to conduct the conversation in received pronunciation.
But let's
not do that right yet. First, Joe, I would like you to play that first track from John Haydock, the late dean of architecture, with a lovely Bronx accent.
The fundamental issue of architecture is that does it affect the spirit or doesn't it? If it doesn't affect the spirit, it's building. If it affects the spirit, it's architecture. And architecture doesn't necessarily mean that it's the final form of a built building. A drawing to me is a completed piece of architecture. A building is a completed piece of architecture. A photograph of a drawing or a photograph of a architecture is a piece of architecture. Each act is individually an act of architecture.
Which means that a story about architecture is an act of architecture. Which means that stagecraft, even though you can't penetrate it, could be architecture if it... How did he put it? If it moves the spirit?
If it moves the spirit.
Yeah. So here, I mean, one might well ask, well, what does acting and architecture have to do? You know, what do they have to do with each other? Well, because we're involved in the art of the narrative, and we're always involved in the art of creation, something that built has not existed before, or a story that has not been told in a specific way before. Before we came on the air, you were telling me about your work concerning the German filmmaker Leni Riefenstahl.
Yes, I just finished a reading of a new work by a composer playwright by the name of Christy Bauer at the York Theater called Leni Riefenstahl is Going to Tell You the Truth, an ironic title, of course.
Where's the York Theater located?
The York Theater is in the City Core building, which is on 53rd and Lexington. Yes.
Right.
So the history of the piece is interesting in and of itself. The writer and composer is a woman, a brilliant woman who's getting a lot of attention lately. She just finished her master's at Tisch in musical theater writing, has had her work produced, just finished her residency at Goodspeed.
Wow.
I happen to know her because the first piece we worked on together, a musical based on The Old Man and the Sea, she wrote in our seventh grade literature class in Louisville, Kentucky at a small conservative Christian private school. And we became fast friends and made a very solemn promise to each other at age 12. We said, you know, we'll go to New York, we'll do this, I'll be an actor and a comedian, you'll be a writer, a composer, and we'll work together on something. Well, 15 years later, we've been friends all this time, but the opportunity had not yet risen for us to actually collaborate on something. And she came to me about 4 years ago and she said, look, I've become fascinated with this figure that is Leni Riefenstahl and her story and how controversial it is. I'd like you to play her. And I said, great. So I began researching her life, which of course is full of taboos and controversy, given her affiliation with the Nazi Party and the work she did for them and their service. But her life as an artist was remarkable. I mean, the things that she was able to accomplish, not only as a woman, as a filmmaker in general, were incredibly groundbreaking. And you can see the influence of her in films such as Star Wars. You could see her influence in popular films throughout the last century. And unfortunately, she was wrapped up in something that was much bigger than herself, which was
the Nazi
caustic
movement
and toxic political movement that was the Nazi Party. And she herself claimed until her death at the age of 101 in Kenya, she died in Germany. She lived in Kenya until she became ill. But she claimed that she did not know the purposes her films were being used for, that she was just creating art, right? Which is absurd, because you go back and you look at her most famous film, of course, Triumph of the Will, and it makes these young Hitler youth look like rock stars.
Absolutely.
And so I've been on working on this project for a long time now. And of course, you know, when I will tell people that I'm working on it, they typically give, as Christy puts it, one of three reactions. One, why the hell are you making... Sorry, one, who is Leni Riefenstahl? Because an alarming amount of well-informed, educated Americans have no idea that she ever existed.
Well, if you didn't study film in college, or if you weren't a political science major, you know, focused on the middle of the 20th century, then you might not know.
Sure. And I mean, as far as innovation is concerned, the fact that any Joe Schmo on the street, of course, knows who George Lucas or Steven Spielberg is,
sure,
that's, or even James Cameron, fine, but they don't know who this woman is who paved the way.
From whom they ripped off, yes, many, 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 yes, visual effects. For those of you who may have just tuned in, this is Burning Down the House, and I'm Curtis B. Wayne speaking with the actor Jen Tulloch. And we're talking about the art of the narrative. And Leni Riefenstahl was very good at creating a narrative,
yes,
through visuals and those funny Dutch angles.
Yeah, and, the first to do it.
Really?
Yeah. She was the first. I mean, I can't speak too much to what she was capable of doing lighting-wise, because I'm afraid I'll say something incorrect, because I've just started researching this part of it myself. But as far as the angles you were talking about, she was the first to... She was shooting... Any time a protagonist was included in the narrative, she would shoot them from underneath, essentially.
Yes.
To give them... to sort of force a perspective of them being, right, larger than life, etc.
In film talk, a Dutch angle is where the angle... The camera is tilted and also looking up a little bit.
Right. And often lit... either harshly lit from behind or from the front.
Mm-hmm.
Film majors will probably tell you otherwise, but she did both. Mm-hmm. So as far as narrative is concerned, we're talking about architecture. It's so interesting. You know, I mentioned earlier that my family had moved abroad for some time, and, mm-hmm, and we moved to Poland. So,
wow,
the biggest chunk of time I spent in another country that wasn't my own was in this place that my parents were living in. They were mostly living in Warsaw, or Warszawa, as they would say. I spent a little time in smaller villages, but my time in Poland as a teenager was obviously very eye-opening as far as the history of the wars and the history of course, the Holocaust. And
well, had Solidarity happened yet, or was it?
I was there in off and on between 1998.
Okay, so Lech Walesa was already,
correct,
in power.
We were sort of in the after wave of that.
Yeah. Cool.
And again, you know, I was an American teenager, so I was sort of a deer in the headlights when it came to I knew a very basic understanding of the country's history, et cetera, et cetera. But you were speaking about the war, obviously, as it relates to Leni Riefenstahl, and with architecture, I remember, you know, I grew up in suburbia in Kentucky. I didn't grow up in farmland. I grew up in a city. I grew up in the suburbs of the city of Louisville. So I remember saying to my parents when I was about 8, I just want to live in a house that looks like an old house. And we were living in all of these cheap houses that would be erected like Legos for lower income families, mm-hmm, that looked new because they had sort of flashy painted over amenities, but of course were made out of essentially cardboard and plastic siding,
yeah,
and little to no character. And I remember being a kid and already being, you know, I had a sort of odd creative mind, and watching these old films that I loved, right, from the golden era of the MGM days, and looking at these buildings and looking at the postcards of the places, so romantic, you know, as an American kid, that I wanted to travel to Paris and London, and thinking, well, our house doesn't look like that. And right, it wasn't a matter of privilege. I didn't want a big house.
Mm-hmm.
It was a matter, I knew that I didn't want carpeted floors.
You keep talking. I'm going to go talk with Joe about what music we have, because
yeah,
I want to get back to being able to have musical breaks, because I'll tell you a funny story about...
Fabulous.
A bit of email that I got. So
sure,
you keep talking.
I'll just finish the story quickly. So we're in this house, and I remember thinking, why do I have pink carpet? I don't, this doesn't feel right. And it wasn't until my parents had an apartment in Poland that I thought, oh yes, this is the kind of place I want to live in. We had hardwood floors and they creaked and the windows were old and they were fogged around the edges. And that was the first time that the actual physical environment of the place I was living in occurred to me. And in traveling to Eastern Europe and seeing these places and seeing how old, the rich and beautiful history of these buildings, and then traveling, you know, to Prague and going to Old Town and seeing these cobblestone squares, seeing the fountains, seeing the elaborate clock towers, I thought, this is something. Obviously, in America, we have our own interesting architectural history.
Yeah, but not like Prague.
No. I mean, I went to school in Decatur, Illinois, and there were a couple of Frank Lloyd Wright houses there, which obviously that's a name.
How did you say that state?
Illinois.
You said Illinois. Oh, that's interesting. I just came back from a day in Chicago, and when I was growing up in Illinois, we pronounced it Illinois.
Sure.
But then some people from downstate pronounced it Illinois.
Uh-huh.
And so even within the state of Illinois, there are regional dialects.
Oh, absolutely.
Which is really sort of funny. Let's take a couple of 3 minutes of some music and reframe a conversation and get back to the narrative of place then, because you've gotten into a nice thread there. Burning Down the House on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm speaking with Jen Tulloch, world traveler and actress, actor.
That's kind of you.
And Jen was just telling us a little story about discovering the value of place and her appreciation, having first grown up in a typical crummy standard American house,
mm-hmm.
to go into great cities of the world, and how mind-blowing that was.
There's something comforting, though, about those houses. And
they're chopping wood next door.
Apparently. They just cut down a pine. My beloved fiance is from a very similar place, and we always joke that, you know, suburban America is suburban America, suburban America. She grew up in New Jersey, obviously a far cry from the southern roots of my upbringing, but our childhood houses look identical, you know? And when we go out there and spend time with her family, who I love dearly, we always, she and I have had very similar experiences. We've traveled quite a bit, you know, I had pretty intense experiences living abroad and have obviously seen very different types of what a house means, what a place means. And when we got to New Jersey, I always say, you know, there's something about eating Ortega tacos in this house with this, you know, area rug, with this carpet, that will always feel like home to me. It's sense memory. That, regardless of what I've developed as my taste as an adult, mm-hmm. that's what's in my muscle memory as home. And it's interesting because it's not necessarily what I've tried to cultivate for my adult life, but I love going back there. And that type of building.
Is it a ranch?
It's a townhouse.
Oh.
It's a townhouse. The house, I grew up in a couple different houses in Kentucky, and they were all split level, you know, carpeted, very, very 90s.
Mm.
Very thin, very thin
yeah.
walls.
Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, a crummy basement and poor carpeting. But I guess my ultimate point was in starting to have an appreciation, not even necessarily an informed one, but a curious appreciation for architecture and the buildings of the world, as you said, I realized the aesthetic of the first home, you know, does have a profound effect and a profound idea. It forms a profound idea of what home is for you. At least that was my experience. You know, these like poorly sited suburban looking houses with cul-de-sacs and very little foliage and a highway for days.
Do you think that your desire to get out into the world, to be here in New York and to be doing a certain kind of craft, which you do, I mean, acting is a craft, architecture is a craft.
Right.
Which takes, for both of us, it takes a lot of training to mm-hmm. even begin to be good.
Right.
You can't just start and be great. You have to continue to do it well. Do you think that your craft is a reaction against the visual poverty of the placeless suburbia?
Even though
that feels like home.
In some sense, it's a reaction against. In some sense, it's totally informed by that. I think having a sensitivity and an empathy, which is mandatory in listening, which is, I feel, the biggest component of acting. You have to listen and engage and develop an empathy for the person that you're acting opposite of or the person you're portraying. That kind of sensitivity and empathy and desire, I feel, was in my life was cultivated because I was from a lower income background and from a sort of suburban American working class environment, because I had that American idea instilled in me from early on, which was you work hard enough and you are alert enough and you will achieve what you want to achieve. So there was no resting on your laurels.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that some of the work that you've done, as I understand, trends towards comedy.
Most of it.
And if I look at the last 35 years of some of the best comic work, principally through the lens of Saturday Night Live.
Sure.
Almost everybody who's come through that came from a suburban background.
Mm-hmm.
Some a little fancier suburbs than others. I mean, Bill Murray was North Shore Chicago, right? Wilmette or Winnetka or something like that. But everybody was pretty much suburban.
Mm-hmm.
And if you compare that with the powerhouse of people in their late 50s, early 60s, I'm thinking specifically of these people who studied, I think it was at Oxford, we have Hugh Laurie and Kenneth Branagh.
Stephen Fry.
And Emma
Thompson.
All came out of Oxford.
Uh-huh. Which
pretty Tony place. Doesn't necessarily mean that they were upper middle class or professional class in background. Their work has a different tenor. You know, it's...
Well, their work has a different national tenor.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know that that's entirely their education. I feel like partly that's a cultural thing. I mean, they're from...
But even in our country, look at Natalie Portman. You know, she went to Harvard. I mean, and she doesn't do comedy.
I don't think she ever could do comedy.
No,
and that's not to say she's not a capable woman. I like Natalie Portman, but she's... That's just not in her wheelhouse. I mean, you talk about Fry and Laurie and Emma Thompson, et cetera. Even French and Saunders, perhaps a tier below the people aforementioned. Those were great influences to me growing up. And that there is a headier tenor to the work they do, of course. But again, that is a cultural thing, because you talk about people coming through Saturday Night Live, for example. If they were given, if they were given a platform to do material closer to something like Fry and Laurie, of course they could. Those are incredibly capable performers, but they're working in a context which is American comedy, American commercial broad comedy, which needs to make fun of American politics. It needs to make fun of American pop culture. That's the material they're given to work with, you know? Sure. And I have great respect for people on that show, and know people that have, a couple people.
Well,
that
I guess, the suburban America or the suburban American life really is the default baseline American experience.
It's the largest. It's the common denominator, right? I feel like any experience below or above that, be it the kid who grew up in Park Slope or grew up in the Upper East Side and went to boarding school and mm-hmm. has three nannies and a language tutor, or the kid who grew up in extreme poverty in the deep south of Louisiana that you and I could never quite understand. Both of those worlds are so far from us, because for me, it's okay. At one point we owned a Toyota. At one point we had carpeted floors. We liked television and we ate white bread. You know, this is the common American experience from my generation, the generation of my parents. And, it's interesting to watch different facets of that changing now as we're moving in to the age of technology.
Yeah, I mean, for myself, from when I was 2 until college, we lived in suburban places. I lived in Arlington Heights, Illinois. Thank you. Well, we could debate that some other time. And then in Monmouth County, New Jersey, because my parents really felt it important that I go to high school with the real Sopranos. We'll talk about that some other time. But when I finally got to architecture school, I could not get enough of learning about Renaissance, Mannerist, and Rococo mm-hmm. architecture, which then informed my understanding of stagecraft.
Yes.
Because that's all about facade.
Yes,
it's largely about facade. We don't talk all that much about, in theoretical terms, the plastic space of the Renaissance so much. We're looking at the facade effects and proportion and scale and ornamental effect, which then gets us straight to Leni Riefenstahl, Nazi. Facadalism, you know, the Nuremberg rallies. It's all about having a space with stage sets all around it.
Absolutely, it was total Hollywood.
And making an architectural statement of a sort of aura mm-hmm. of place. Joe, could you play the next John Haidt clip, please?
John, we live in an age in which a lot of minor criticism concerns context. If these are built, are they built without context? And how do you deal with critics who would speak of these as maybe too nomadic? How would you respond to
nomadic,
that?
Nomadic, because we're in a nomadic time. I mean, that's an absurdity. Anybody says that. I remember Dr. Eisenman coming to Berlin and seeing these two pieces of the in this great hall. They were 50 foot high, and people didn't come into the hall because of the kind of presence. They were giving off something, right? We talked about an aura, a thing like that. And he says to me that they're not architecture because you can't get in them. And I looked at him and I said, you can't get in them. In other words, he was not in the position to get into them because he did not understand that. You can only get into something if you understand or are willing to. So the reality of it is that I've built, believe it or not, in the last couple of years, 14 structures. That's a lot of work. But the silence that has gone over them, people see them, but they go, ooh.
Yeah. Now that is, well, this is the man who taught me architecture.
I am so jealous.
He's something, huh?
The Woods.
The Woods. When he was really riled up, he would go for the Bronx accent,
and he would raise his voice,
and then he would let silence happen. I learned a lot from being around him.
Yeah.
When I was in architecture school, I took every possible not required course in either acting, set design, or costume design, which then ended up that I became familiar with our theater teacher, Robert Israel, who, as it turned out, was best friends with Philip Glass.
Oh, that guy.
Yeah, he'd come in and tell us about his friend Phil. He was driving a taxi, but he was writing interesting music. And
yeah, you know, I love the old adage of he played a concert at Carnegie Hall. It was the premiere of a couple of his new movements, and he got in his taxi to work the night after, and somehow his name was on the little placard in his taxi, and the guy, his passenger said, "Oh, you know, you have the same name as a very famous composer."
Yeah, that guy. and so I ended up collaborating on a stage set for the Prokofiev opera bouffe Love of Three Oranges.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I love Prokofiev's music. But the set was a fixed set, and it was adapted from a Borromini church. Now, Bob had the idea, but I was able to draw it up and scale it down so that it would fit within the proscenium space of the municipal theater in Amsterdam. And so you couldn't get into it. But in your mind, you could get into it.
Sure, if you were willing.
If you were willing to understand it, it was an act of architecture.
Yes.
Have you worked in anything that was operatic at all?
No, that's not true. I'll be honest. The piece that we were just speaking about, the Leni Riefenstahl piece, is a large part of it is music. I was singing most of it.
Uh-huh.
I by no means would call it an opera. It is, if you had to classify it, I suppose it could be called a cabaret or even a musical. But it's that was the closest thing I've done in about 12 years that would be anything near to.
Well, cabaret. A cabaret format would be sort of ironic, since the Nazis so detested the cabaret world of the 20s.
Which is why the Candor and Ebb piece, Cabaret, was so profound.
It was terrific.
Yeah. My mother was a singer, still is, a beautiful singer, and an actress from time to time, and worked on things that were closer to that when I was growing up. I was lucky in Louisville. We had the Kentucky Opera, which was great. The Kentucky Center for the Performing Arts, they'd have all, you know, the national tours of musicals come through and whatnot, and they had the Louisville Orchestra and the Louisville Ballet. So even in our, you know, small southern town, I was exposed to things like that. And I remember the first opera I ever saw, at least at the Kentucky Opera, was The Magic Flute.
Wow.
And the song, I don't remember what the actual translation is, the original in English, it's Now I Know That Love Can Vanish. And
who sings that? Papagena or Tamina?
It's Tamina. No?
It's the Magic Flute is, yes, a big piece of work.
It is a big piece of work. But that was the first opera I ever saw. And I grew up with my grandparents would always play me Verdi and Puccini. You know, they liked the sort of mainstream greats that everyone comes to love, you know, Tosca and,
yeah, sure,
La Boheme and what have you. But that was the first opera I was forced to see. The first opera I saw of my own volition, and the first set that changed my life.
Yes.
I saw Carmen.
Wow.
And I saw Carmen when I was in London.
How old were you?
I was 20. And
because Carmen is a really sophisticated.
Oh my God,
Bizet, that's adult stuff.
Georges Bizet is, I mean, a genius.
Yeah, yeah.
And Carmen, of all of the repertoire of brilliant operas, and there are so many that I do love, but Carmen was the one, the first one that I thought, oh my God, I'll never be the same. And that set, oh my God, when you entered the theater, there was a soprano on a sort of the back wall. It was a proscenium stage, slightly raked, and the back wall was black brick, and there was a woman standing on a window washing rig, for lack of a better term.
Mm-hmm. A catwalk, maybe.
Yes. But it looked like it wasn't a catwalk full across. I mean, it was just a bucket.
Oh.
And she was writing names on a wall with white chalk. And she was singing a descant. And it was admittedly a bizarre production of Carmen. I've now seen it a couple of times. But I remember there was a pool of water downstage from which one of the characters arose in this triumphant moment.
It sounds like one of those... Peter, what's his name? The
Peter Jacobs?
No, the British guy.
Oh my God. All of my theater professors right now are screaming at me. Peter, not Peter Sellers.
Yes.
Yes, Peter Sellers.
Yes.
I always get the two Peter Sellers confused.
Yeah, 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 yes,
the actor,
yes,
and the director.
Yes, yes.
Yes, Peter Sellers, who did the famous Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yes.
With the aerial.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds like a Peter Sellers production.
It was like a Peter Sellers production. Unfortunately, it wasn't Mr. Sellers. I also saw a production, speaking of set design specifically and bodies of water on stage, I saw a production of Hecuba while in London that year. And the prologue of Hecuba is this very chilling soliloquy given by Hecuba's, I think it's Hecuba's dead son. It's a deceased person. I'm pretty sure it's her son. When you enter the theater of this particular production, there was no curtain. The stage was, what's it called? Goodness gracious, not a proscenium when it's a thrust. It was a half thrust.
Uh-huh.
And so there was no way to curtain it. You know, it was open and you were looking at the set. Mm-hmm. And there was a large sand dune that comprised most of the back. It was a large theater. And then at the base of the sand dune was a water reservoir.
Oh, wow.
And it looked very shallow. The light was bouncing off of it. It looked like a little puddle. And I was like, oh, well, you know, they've put a puddle on stage. Okay. And similar to the Carmen production, someone came out of that water.
Excellent.
Stood up. The first moment of the piece, the first words spoken, the ghost of this character, and he was all in white, and, you know, his eyes were hollowed out. He stood up. And you'd,
out of the water, yeah.
And there was no curtain announcement. There was no flickering of the lights.
Mm-hmm.
You're sitting in the house, you know, talking to the person next to you, looking at the program, and all of the sudden, this 20-year-old kid stands up from this pool of water and inhales and begins the prologue. And that's
super.
Water on stage is such an interesting device. And I was talking to someone about this the other day, and they said, a friend of mine who's a director said, oh, I hate it. You know, it's so divisive. It's so gimmicky. And I said, look, I'm not a designer myself. I can only speak as an actor and an audience member. Of the three or four times I've seen it used, they were all incredibly effective.
Well, you know, we respond in almost, we're genetically coded to respond to water or to the word that's going around a lot these days, to biophilic features.
I mean,
fire is not biophilic, but, you know, it's certainly elemental. But water and greenery in any setting evokes very strong feelings in people. Now, in a stage, well, sometimes they do fire. Sometimes there's water. Sometimes there's sand. It reminds me of a funny story. If you've just tuned in, this is Burning Down the House. We're talking with Jen Tulloch about the convergence between stagecraft and architecture, generally, loosely. A friend of mine, Cynthia Rose, was a mezzo-soprano with City Opera, and she was to sing the second production of Philip Glass's opera, Akhenaten. She was going to be Nefertiti.
Wow.
And it had been produced the year before. And the opera company decided, because the whole set was covered with sand, because it was Egypt, they decided to save the sand. So after, you know, 20 performances of people walking around in their bare feet in the sand, and then it got packed up, and then it got spread back out on the stage the next year, it was full of fungus, and she got such a respiratory infection, she couldn't sing it.
Sand fungus.
Yes. Yeah, well, yeah, I mean,
the role typically played by Miss Philippa Blackwell, tonight we played by because of sand fungus.
Yes. So there are hazards, practical hazards that that befall productions.
Sure.
But
I wanted to talk about.
Let's get back to narrative a little bit, Joe. Give us a couple more minutes of some music. Burning Down the House on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. We're speaking with Jen Tulloch. I was going to tell you a charming email that came in, since you're a co-host on
The Morning After,
which precedes this in live time. A very lovely bit of email from San Francisco arrived a few weeks ago saying, because we've had to change the format to only use music that we have permission to use.
Right.
We can't just use anybody's random stuff because it's wrong. Saying, well, I did one program where I had no musical breaks, and this listener wrote in and said, no, go for the whole hour. I like the expansiveness, the breaks, you know, they allow people to reframe their thoughts and for you to continue, so don't do it. So we're back to the
loyal emailer.
Yeah, so we're back to the long format, and I think it, you know, it lets us have conversations.
Well, this is old radio, right? I mean, this is what people used to do before we all became so ADD.
Yeah.
That we couldn't go more than 5 minutes without checking our smart devices.
That's right.
I far prefer this method and think it causes you to think in a longer form.
Well, it gives us time to get into other stuff. Now, I mean, in terms of stagecraft, you can just tell a story. I mean, you could stand on stage and just read the script, and you know, you could even read the stage directions. You know, he walks up stage and leaves, or you know, whatever the stuff that's. It all depends on who the playwright is as to how elaborate that is, right?
Sure.
Back when I was in college, The sort of the new wave of German playwright was very much in vogue, certainly Watzek and all that stuff from the 20s, but there were new guys, and they wrote elaborate stage directions, like just they couldn't leave it to the director's whim as to where people should be on stage, which was kind of tiresome, but it made for interesting reading.
Tennessee Williams
was
very specific, yes, about the set he had in mind.
But in acting, you create space through body awareness, right?
Right.
I mean, mimes do a really crappy job of creating space. Everyone loves to hate mimes because they're you know, they're disturbing.
I don't hate mimes. Actually, I think that mime in its traditional form is an incredibly difficult form of acting, and one that not a lot of people can achieve, because it seems like such an archaic performance art now.
Yeah.
Because there's not really a contemporary context for it.
No.
And of course, everybody knows the like joke of the mime in the box, you know, when he's got the beret on and the white face and the white gloves. But I have friends that studied mime in Paris and studied various forms of physical theater at the Lecoq School, Jacques Lecoq, and there are all of these, you know, guys that were doing this at the turn of the century that I think were able to achieve actually a really beautiful heightened form of physical performance. But it is, you're right, it is about creating physical space, and theater as an actor, that big divide for most of us is you're either working on stage or you're working on film. And what's the difference there as far as space is concerned, as far as physical space and the world that you're working in?
Yeah.
In the theater, you're working in a world that is, the fantasy is tangible because it's been built. There's a back and a front. You look forward and there are literal human beings staring at you with eyeballs, right?
But potentially the frame bleeds.
Yes.
Film hardly ever bleeds beyond the frame that the cinematographer has created.
Sure. Unless you're doing like a Tim Burton film, you know, on a soundstage that's 8 miles long. But
yeah. But in theater, space could infinitely extend into the wings. It could, you know, it could be very deep.
Right.
It could encompass the entire theater if you're doing, I guess, Spider-Man, right?
Right.
or Cirque du Soleil, which is not acting.
For Zabruta.
Yes. Yes, exactly. But that's a matter of the actors being, having body awareness in the space created by the set. Now, there's a trend in architectural theory these days of trying to be predictive in how people, when entering an architectural space, and not all space is architectural, some is just, it's just there, or a sequence of spaces, how they will react in the space. Will they have enough cultural clues to know their way? It's called wayfinding, and some of it gets into this very new emerging concept of architectural, not philosophy, but psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And they borrow from behavioral psychology, that if you brightly light something, then the eye is attracted to it, and then you want to approach it. And, you know, we use that in theater with lighting effects, right? And you're talking about water on stage could create motion.
Yes.
You know, it could. Or it could just be a big puddle. I mean, you know.
Right.
I mean, they did Midsummer Night's Dream summer before this on a stage that was just full of water, and people were just splashing around in it, and it was just sort of a dead effect. It didn't really do anything. Nobody liked it, and nobody really understood it, so they couldn't get into it because the actors didn't develop a narrative why it was that they were walking around in a wading pool, which means they bombed.
I just had a friend do a production of Romeo and Juliet, actually in my hometown at a theater called Actors Theater of Louisville, and I wasn't able to see the production, but she told me she was doing it, and I went and I looked at the photos, and it was the trend with doing Shakespeare anywhere in the last 20 years. Of course, it was very contemporary, and they were all in a modern dress, and there was a swimming pool that seemed to be the center of the set. It looked like it was a back patio and a very large swimming pool. And it looked to me that, you know, that any of the fight scenes with Tybalt or Mercutio and Benvolio were all in the pool. They're in the pool. They ended up fighting in the pool. And again, I didn't see the production, so it could have been brilliant or not brilliant. I don't know. I'm sure it was great because that theater is fantastic. But
I was thinking about that when we started talking about water on stage. I thought, you know, I just my friend just did a Romeo and Juliet with a literal swimming pool on stage. I mean, we're not talking about a puddle. We're talking about an in-ground, you know, aqua hole. And
somehow that reminds me of that hip-hop version of that South Beach hip-hop version of Romeo and Juliet with the lurid colors that was
done. The one that Baz Luhrmann did?
Yeah.
Yes, Baz Luhrmann's William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet with yeah. Claire Danes and Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah.
Which I actually really love.
It's really trippy.
It's really trippy. It's incredibly trippy. I mean, Baz Luhrmann, what an eye. What a brain. Yes, that was intense. That came out when I was, oh God, I'm going to give away my age. I was in the sixth grade when that came out.
Oh, so you're about 18 now.
That's right. I'm really excited to vote in this election for the first time.
I caught that after it had been in the theaters. I don't know if it actually had much of a theatrical play, but
I don't think so. It was more of a cult hit, as was the soundtrack. Is. That was one of the first films of my generation that a popular film, a commercially popular film that had a hit soundtrack. People I knew that hadn't even seen the film were talking about getting the soundtrack because he had. Baz Luhrmann commissioned a bunch of bands, including Radiohead, to write songs based on the film, mm-hmm. based on the story,
uh-huh.
which was interesting. You know, you're 12 years old, and it's Claire Danes and Leonardo DiCaprio and Shakespeare. There was all of the hormonal angst I was experiencing at the time was perfectly channeled through through that film.
Well, Shakespeare lives on.
Hormonal angst.
Well... the humor still lives. I mean, you have to, if you're taking it totally uncut and untranslated.
Sure, of course.
You know, in its 16th century language, some of the words have changed meanings, but
it just requires you to think for a moment. That's all.
Yeah.
That's the thing. I feel people can become intimidated by Shakespeare, especially young actors. You know, it's like, oh shit, what is this? What am I saying here? But if you just take it and sound it out, think about the context, you know, it's often pretty self-explanatory.
What's funny to me is that a lot of American actors, when they're trying to do Shakespeare, then start getting a little British. And they start drifting over into some sort of version or simulacrum of something that I've heard on the television.
There's a word for the accent that you're talking about, and it's called transatlantic.
Transatlantic.
And transatlantic for years was taught in acting schools. This is back in the 40s and 50s. And probably beyond that. I don't know that anyone would actually teach it now, but it was taught to newscasters. And I actually have a friend who's a news anchor now. That's what she does for a living. And we went to acting school together. And she said, you won't believe it. I went when I was studying. They were talking about transatlantic. And I said, oh, my God. But it's essentially the idea of sort of snapping our very hard-sounding American accent back to...
Smoothing it out a bit.
Elongating the vowels. Because it's easier when you're on stage. It's America. The way we speak in America is very clipped. Everything's very narrow, you know, and the mouth doesn't have to move very much. And when you're on stage, there's no way to send sound that way.
Yes, you have to. So, you have to speak from the back of your mouth.
Right, exactly. Open it up.
I love doing that just to startle people. The actor who was in Local Hero, we could look him up. Anyway, he was the main guy, and he was also in Animal House. Ended up being befriended by one of our partners, and we have people who drop by and they just do impromptu little talks. And he was talking about being an actor just means you just have to keep practicing and just keep doing it.
Yeah.
And you have to understand that architects tend to be really introverted people.
Mm-hmm.
You get a lot of people around and they sit, it's like Quaker meeting. And so after he talked to a little bit, and he does anybody have any questions? And so it'd be, well, how was it to work with John Belushi? You know, very quiet, very quiet. And I happen to like public speaking, And eventually you learn how to project your voice, right? Mm-hmm. So I was in the opposite corner, and you know, he was about to break up. And so I decided to put my voice over there. It was like, so do you prefer stage acting or film? And he turned around, and he's like, wait, something's going on here. You know, I caught his eye, and he's got you. you've had training, which is kind of fun, you know? You could really fuck with people if you have just a little tiny bit of experience. As an architect, you can use it to great effect, because when we're making presentations, you're having to get people's attention and empathy so that they can get into understanding what you're trying to explain. Mm-hmm. And that was a lot of fun.
I
did that in Chicago, Illinois, last Wednesday. We had a group of builders, developers, and architects debating the American dream. Is it sustainable? You know, the 2.5 kids, a yard, 2 cars, and a dog on a fair size of lawn. And these were people who mostly do single-family houses, and a lot of them were from California and the Midwest. And they really still believe in that. And they were looking, and we were getting pushback. It was a sort of a town hall format where I'd introduce a point of argument, and people say, I disagree. Well, come up and talk. And it was very interesting, because although these people were not in any way trained to be able to speak in public, they could still be very passionate. So one last question that I have is that, how do you get, I mean, so you have all this experience and have all this training, but you're playing a character that's just an ordinary person.
Right.
You have to get into a head of not knowing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Because you have to find the humanity. I mean, there is a point in which, quote unquote, training and
yeah, and that's where a lot of Tennessee Williams for me falls down, because the actors know too much. I mean, there's all this pathos. Like, you pick up the glass menagerie. Mm-hmm. There's so much pathos there. And it's just so easy to just be emoting all over the place.
I don't think that's the text. I think that's a matter of who approaches it. I mean, I'm a big fan of Tennessee Williams. The man was a genius. And I feel like that's a matter of direction, first and foremost. That's the role of a director, to say, look, this is what you know. This is who you are as a real person. Mm-hmm. This is your role in this story. How do we cut that down, and how malleable is it, and how?
Yeah, how do you turn your internal volume down to become ordinary?
I mean, again, it's all about context, as I'm sure it is. We were listening to that clip before about context. It's another great through line between what you and I do. Is I'm doing, for example, this piece about Lady Riefenstahl. I'm playing a very infamous historical figure in a musical context, which in itself requires a bit more volume, not just physical volume, but abstract volume, a bit more volume and character, a bit more volume and personality. There's that. And then I'm also working on a political satire piece that's a film, and I'm playing a politician in that, and that's very, that's a bit more mute, you know, that's a bit more indicated, that's a bit more, I suppose, low-fi when it comes to giving things away as an actor.
Is this going to be a stage work, or is this going to be a film?
No, this is a film that I'm talking about now. Uh-huh. So the relationship between, as far as the Leni Riefenstahl piece was concerned, for me it was just, the challenge was very simple. It was making her human, and my sort of building and essaying of her character, it was about seeing the child in her, because she was a foxy and rather sexy woman, and she was, pardon me, an intellectual. Finding the child in either of those archetypes, I feel, is the easiest way to sort of see their humanity and see their see their Achilles heel to think about someone as a child. And so I made a lot of her argumentative exchanges with people, whether she was defending herself, defending her films, defending her political allegiances or lack thereof, as she claimed. I made them very childlike and almost, because I've seen actual footage of her. You know, I watched, there's this documentary, I believe it's called The Terrible Wonderful Life of Leni Riefenstahl. And she was like an impetuous child. I mean, she was incredibly stubborn and given to throwing little tantrums. And so you're asking me, you know, how you sort of turn down what you are, turn down your internal impulse to be believable as someone else. And I, of course, can only be me, Jen. But I, as Jen, I had to sort of figure out what to relate to in this person, in this figure. And for me, it was her childlike, sort of stubborn insistence upon getting her way.
Well, you just said that you can only be you, Jen. And someone once suggested to me that the difference between American actors and British actors is that British actors actually play the role, whereas American actors play themselves playing the role.
I don't think that's a fair statement, because I think it depends on the background that you have as an actor. I think it depends on the context of acting. Film acting often is its own.
But I think there are very few American actors who can really not be playing themselves. I'm thinking of, for example, Brad Pitt in 12 Monkeys. Do you know that film?
Sure.
And he's wonderful at being absolutely insane. And he totally owns that character. And it's not Brad Pitt that we know from other movies.
But you're talking about character acting, which is what I do. I only play characters that are remarkably older, younger than me.
Well, I'm not talking about sitcom. I'm not talking about Jerry
No, I'm talking about character acting in theater.
Okay.
Character acting. This is a classic thing. Character acting, meaning actors that often play roles that are a little more extreme and oftentimes a dramatically different age than themselves. For me, saying that you... this is a common... this is one of the first things they'll teach you in acting school. You are you. And you are playing this character. You have to remember that to inject your own humanity into it. It doesn't matter how much I show up and I can be like the 19, you know, I can be a 75-year-old old, you know, Broadway workhorse, and then I'm that person and it's fine. And I have a history and I have a mannerisms. Of course, I become that person. But I'm also using my... it's impossible and very stupid, I think, not to inform your character that you're playing with your own life experiences. I just did dialect coaching with this amazing BBC Royal Shakespeare actress named Suzanne Burdish.
And how did that go?
It went great. We have the same agent, which is how we met. And she...
splendid.
Suzanne was in the Royal Shakespeare Company for years. She did the infamously long Royal Shakespeare production of Nicholas Nickleby. She played Fanny in that and got critical acclaim. She's a remarkable character herself, and incredibly brilliant and a very generous teacher. And she had done a very specific type of German accent in a production recently. And I struck up a conversation with her in the lobby of our agent's office. And I said, oh, I'm working on this Riefenstahl thing. She said, do you need help with the dialect? And I sort of confidently said, no, I don't. And she said, well, how does it sound? And we got to talking. She said,
so how does it sound?
Well, the particular version of the dialect I came up with for this was not a direct German accent, because 90 minutes in a theater space of an actual, literally correct, late 1930s German accent would drive you out of the theater. It's too clipped. There's no way to carry a story, and there's no way to carry the musicality of a story with, you know, this, that is what's here, and this is very harsh, and you find and all the values are here. That's too... nobody wants to hear that. And so I Leni Riefenstahl learned English from Englishmen.
Yes.
And so I sort of made a hybrid...
and that makes it
accent for
even
her.
Creepier, doesn't it?
Yes. I made a hybrid dialect for her that was equal parts Marlene Dietrich, because it was a cabaret.
Yeah, sure.
Equal parts Berlin and equal parts London. So it was... that allowed the vowels to open up. But anyway, my point was, you were talking about American actors versus English actors.
Yes.
Suzanne Burdish has an American parent and an English parent, but was raised in London. Or raised in England, actually, I think outside of London. Trained there. And we, in that coaching, we had this conversation, you know, about American actors and English actors.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, you know, I'm a character actor. That's what I do. I only do characters and I rarely play characters or anywhere close to myself. And as a young actor, that's sort of confusing because that's oftentimes in this industry not something you do until a little later in life. And she said, she said, well, let me stop you there.
Yeah.
And I said,
but.
Well, okay. She said, you are you and you are playing Lady Riefenstahl. Doll. It's that simple. And I said, yes, but I'm, you know, I've created this really epic, you know, structure for her. And I've created this voice. And she said, that's fine. That's great. You can keep that. You are you. And you are playing her. You cannot forget either one of those things. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, every bit of you that you bring to this, married with every bit of her that you built from scratch, is equally as important. And you trust you. And the story will tell itself. And it seems kind of cheeky and sentimental, but it was really sage advice. And I thought about that in doing the piece. I did, and it was helpful.
See, I think you would have done a better German accent if you had learned some German, because then you speak the English using the German sounds. For me, this is very easy because I am almost fluent in German and I worked in a Swiss bank with this Fitzerdeutsch people who speak a slightly different accent.
Mm-hmm.
And I could go along like this all day long.
But see, I know very few German people and I know quite a few. When I was living in Poland, I was friends with a lot of German people.
Sure.
who actually say this.
This is all the time.
This is not... This is an American...
I know Germans who says this.
Yeah. But on every... That's the thing in a theatrical context. You cannot make consistent changes like that.
You can't really say this in German.
Let me ask you this. You're sitting there in a chair with a microphone.
Yeah.
Saying that to me. Oh, this is a German accent. You put yourself in a theater with 250 people.
Then it probably doesn't work.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
Then you have to go... But then it becomes like the... like the war movies where the Germans are really speaking with a British accent.
Yeah, sure. Well, they were all English actors.
Which is then it's equivalent to the Roman era films where all the Romans are speaking with a British accent because mm-hmm. they're all British.
Regional production of Les Miserables where everyone insists upon using a Cockney accent. Why is that?
I don't know. Because Les Miserables is French.
Takes place in France. It's always baffled me, even especially when it's on like bad regional productions in a community theater in the middle of, you know, Duluth. And people are like, lovely lady, so I think for a bite. And I'm like, why?
Wait, you just turned it into Oliver
about
Twist.
France. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Well, okay, I think we've come to the end of our allotted time. How quickly an hour goes. This has been great fun. Plug yourself. You have a website, correct?
I do. It's just my name, gentulloc.com, gentulloc.com. If you so desire, you can track the progress of the Riefenstahl piece I was talking about. I have a new, posting a new video tomorrow, a little spoof film about the musical Annie, which is having a revival on Broadway. And then I'm...
No.
Yes. So I shot a mockumentary about the orphans all grown up. And I play Pepper, who's a meth head stripper in Camden, New Jersey.
Okay.
And I'm doing a couple other things around the city for the next couple months. But that site's the easiest way to keep up.
And what happens to Annie?
Annie is a Tribeca pill-popping heiress who wants nothing to do. Annie Warbucks Sheen.
Yes, of course.
That's her married name. I'll send you the link when I post it tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a lot of fun.
Tomorrow. Okay. Thank you very much. This has been Burning Down the House. I'm Curtis B. Wayne speaking with Jen Tulloc about this, that, and the other thing that sort of ties architecture and acting together, in which we can all bomb. Thank you for listening. Keep the faith.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.